ready. It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
It's a very special episode of the Wayne's Comics Podcast, number 117. This week I get to talk with Mark Guggenheim, showrunner for Arrow on the CW. We talk a little bit about how the show appeals to both comics fans and non-comics fans, as well as other things about the program, which is a huge success. And I have to say, I was a little nervous talking with him because I'm such a fan of the show. Then I also talk with Douglas Wolk, the creator of Judge Dredd Mega City 2, which is a great comic coming out from IDW. He talks about how he's been a fan of Dredd for a long time, and we talk a lot about what he's planning to do in this excellent miniseries. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. It's a distinct honor and a pleasure to talk today with Mark Guggenheim, the showrunner for Arrow on the CW and also an accomplished comics creator. How are you doing today, Mark?
Very good, very good. How are you?
Good. It's good to talk with you. First off, I want to touch a little bit on your comics creatorship and talk particularly about a book that I miss these days. It's called Resurrection from Oni Press.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. One that's near and dear to my heart.
The thing you did with that book that I really loved was you brought in some real people into it, including President Clinton, which I found interesting. It made it more realistic because you did that kind of stuff. People refer to it as the alien version of Walking Dead. And with Walking Dead so well on television, getting all these ratings, I was thinking, why not do Resurrection on television, too, since you're successful with Arrow?
Well, thank you. You know, we talk about it, actually, and it does come up, and I think my schedule and workload has probably been the biggest limitation in terms of setting it up somewhere. But, you know, I never say never, and I love Resurrection and the world of Resurrection, and in fact, I was just earlier this week, you know, talking to a director about it. So it's never dead, and I'm glad it's not forgotten. And my hope is to one day, you know, sort of get it out there either in comic book form again or as a television show or even a movie maybe, because I still feel like there are stories to tell in that universe, and I'm, you know, hopeful I'll get a chance to tell them.
Yeah, I miss it. It's one of those books that you, when it came out, it would be the top of my stack because I wanted to read that first.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that.
Now, you also did a run on The Flash, which I enjoyed, and I have to say that the Barry Allen you started in the two episodes there with on Arrow was just great. I liked the character. He's just so personable and so unlike Oliver that, you know, he stands out to me and is really this great character who interacts with Felicity and is a very different person. It was nice to see that not everybody in Arrow is going to be like Oliver, that they're going to be very different people. So did the comic writing have any influence on the character when you brought him into Arrow?
No. Well, I mean, not mine. I wasn't involved too much in the writing of the two Barry Allen episodes because that's the domain of Andrew Kreisberg, Jeff Johns, and Greg Berlanti, who are doing the Flash series. But, you know, I think it was a goal of all of the producers, myself included, that Barry not feel like a clone of Oliver, that Oliver and Barry could share scenes together and you didn't feel like it was just two Olivers sharing the screen. And when we saw Grant Gustin and Stephen Amell in their first set of scenes together, we really felt like, oh, you're now, you really see two different shows, you know, two different shows in one scene, which was really the ambition.
Well, I enjoyed it very much. I think it's a great way to talk to The Flash. And, of course, The Flash has a television history. And I always loved the original Flash show that came out on CBS a long time ago. And so I loved what you did with him on Arrow. And I think he's a great character.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I love the original CBS show, too. And it's, you know, I know Jeff and Greg and Andrew also, you know, have a lot of affection for it. And, you know, it... You know, in many ways, it sort of laid the foundation for shows like Arrow.
Now,
let's get to Arrow, because I'm dying to talk about the show. This is such a terrific show. It you do something on the show I don't think I've ever seen a television show that's based on a comic character do before, and that is provide a balance in such a way that not only comics fans enjoy it, but also the general viewing audience really likes it. And I think that is such a special thing. I talk to people who don't ever open a comic book, and they tell me how great it is. And also comics people, we get together and talk about all the wonderful things, the little Easter eggs in there, like Judge Grell at one point and things like that. All those things are in there. And I just – did you start out the show, or do you – still continue making Arrow in that way that it will appeal to, because general people don't get the Judge Grell or the mention of the movement recently in an episode.
Correct.
They don't get those things.
Well, it's sort of like we always say it's like the adult humor in Pixar films, you know, or DreamWorks movies, where you know, it for the kids it goes over their heads, but the adults get it and appreciate it. And you know, we never want it to be distracting, but at the same time, we're comic book fans, and, you know, we like seeing things with Easter eggs, and we write and produce the kind of show we want to watch. And, you know, the show has always been designed to be like a mini movie, and I think if you look at, you know, all the successful superhero movies, you know, obviously those movies are drawing in a broader audience than just comic book readers. So we're trying to provide sort of the same kind of viewing experience. And I think that's why it appeals to comic book fans and non-comic book fans alike.
Well, it's just, you know, nothing against the CW, but this is not what I consider to be a general CW show. You know, CW show has a lot to do with angst and teen relationships in the early 20s and stuff like that. And, you know, that serves an audience. There's no problem with that. But this show, when it first came on, I was floored. I just, the first episode, and I didn't realize that was Deathstroke's mask hanging off of that pole in there until I saw it a second time, and I went, whoa, I said, that's Deathstroke's mask. So you have done a great job to me of making these things happen. And I'm so interested in the character development as well. You have seen more character development in two seasons of Arrow than most television shows ever see. You know, you've got Oliver. Oliver has gone from a person who didn't have a problem with killing and turned into somebody who is actually using his wits a lot more. And like for in the recent episode where he shot an arrow and cut the cord so the guy couldn't detonate a bomb, I said, you know, that was pretty smart. And, you know, and you've got to give Stephen Amell credit too, because what he does is in the first season he was sort of the stiff character, you know, who didn't understand how to interact with people. Now he's much more relaxed around people, and he does things. So you guys, this is one of those cases, I think, when the writing and the acting and the effects and everything all work together. It's kind of like magic. You know, these things don't happen all the time, but you've got this wonderful thing going on. And I just have to say that you guys are doing such a great job with it. And I just, every week at Wednesday at 8 o'clock, I'm glued to the television because, God, what a great show.
Thank you. I really, really appreciate that. Everyone, we have a lot of people who work extremely hard to make the show week in, week out, and it's not a show that comes easy for anybody. So it's, you know, it's kind of words like that that make it all worthwhile for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to talk a little bit about the quote-unquote mid-season finale that you had, which blew people away. All my friends on Facebook were going like, holy smoke, you know, because we didn't realize what Slade was going to be up to. I mean, I didn't dream that he was going to be in the current continuity as well as in the past. And
Good. Well, then we caught you by surprise a little bit.
Oh, I love that. I was just, my jaw hit the floor, and I just, wow, I said, I can't believe that. And that leads me to one thing that I do want to talk about, is that Lost did a lot of fading backs and, you know, and backstory and stuff, but a lot of times it wouldn't have anything to do with what was going on. But you are doing, when you do the flashbacks, they are actually just as engrossing to me as the regular story is that's going on in Starling City. And I often wish that the people that you could have done this first so that Lost could have done a better job with this.
Well, that's really kind. Look, I mean, the truth of the matter is that there would be no Arrow without Lost, or at least not Arrow in its as you would recognize it. I mean, Lost, I think, changed the face of network television and contributed a lot of things. I mean, it introduced things like nonlinear structure and a complex mythology and a lot of characters that they've. They did a lot of things right, and truth is, Arrow is standing on Lost shoulders, as well as the shoulders of other shows, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and X-Files and a whole host of shows that are points of inspiration for us, our hope is that we're honoring those shows with our show and hopefully one day another show will pick up from where Arrow leaves off and continue to contribute to, essentially a dialogue with the viewers.
Mm-hmm. Now, the one thing I do want to ask you about is it has to do with the advertising of the show. And I don't know if you have anything to do with this or not, but this is another kind of thing that makes Arrow special. The first season, we saw a lot of ads, like, for example, in comics, that had Stephen Amell without a shirt on, and all the ladies love that. And so they did that in the first season. Second season came out, and suddenly we began to see the other male actors without their shirts on. And that was one of those self-aware kind of things that I soon as I saw the ad, I laughed. I said, oh, man, they realized what they had done in the past and are actually building on that in the present. I thought that was a very self-aware thing to do. And so many people I know said that was just the greatest little bit of advertising to do it that way. Did you have anything to do with that, or was that PR, basically?
No, that was all the CW's amazing marketing people. Paul Hewitt and Rick Haskins, they do some incredible stuff over there, and they always, it's funny, they always know exactly the right way to sell the show, and they always do it with a very large amount of self-awareness, but also a little bit of humor, and just some fun, fun elements, luckily we have a cast also that is game.
Yeah. Well, they did a great job with that. I just smiled when I saw it. So many of my friends said, have you seen these ads for Arrow? And I said, yes. Great stuff. Now, I want to talk a little bit more about Slade, because the character kind of fascinates me in that he's, we talked about Oliver growing. Now we've seen Slade go in a different direction. He starts out as kind of a heroic person, a little gruff around the edges. But now, because of the drug that's gone into him and Roy Harper, which is another thing that's driving me crazy, what's going to happen to him? But the Slade character, to me, has just been such an interesting thing. I had read somewhere that the ratings actually went up when you added the character to the show. Was that true?
Yes. That is true, and I think the very first time we trended on Twitter was when Colton's name and Roy Harper trended on Twitter. So pretty cool. Pretty cool, I have to say. Colton's got quite a following, and he's been a phenomenal addition to the show, obviously. And could not be happier having him, as part of the Arrow family.
Is there any kind of response to his sort of going to the dark side? Are some of the fans unhappy with that because they like the actor?
If they are, I haven't been made aware of that. I'll be very curious to see what the fan response to episode 12 is, which is the episode that airs this coming Wednesday, because that's a big movement forward for Roy in his evolution from sort of pickpocket to hero. I'm pretty sure the fans will support it. Colton, it's hard, no matter what we do, no matter what we have Roy do, it's very hard not to like Roy, because Colton is just such a likable character.
Okay. As far as Arrow going forward, do you have any plans that you can share with us? And, of course, no spoilers, but have you decided where you're going at the end of this season and maybe next season?
Yeah, we've actually mapped out the remaining episodes. We have 6 episodes left to break, and we know what happens in each one of those episodes. We just have to work out the specific story moves. But the plan for the season is set, and when we can get there, it's always exciting to see how we're going to catch all the plates that we've thrown up since the beginning of the year. We always play the long game, and I'm very excited. We're going to end the season in very dramatic fashion, but at the same time, it'll be a very different kind of finale than last year's finale, as it should be. It should feel like a different animal, a different beast.
Well, you're doing a terrific job. There's so many of us out there who are fans of Arrow and watch it week to week and get together and talk about it afterwards. So just keep up the terrific work. It's such a wonderful show that is so great on so many levels. So please keep it up.
I absolutely will. Thank you so much on behalf of the show. We really, really appreciate it.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored. I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
Now at MajorSpoilers.com.
Welcome to the podcast, Douglas Wolk, the creator of Judge Dredd Mega City 2 Court of Courts from IDW. How are you doing today, Doug?
Doing pretty well. Thanks.
Good, good.
Thanks so much for having me on. The subtitle of Mega City 2 is actually City of Courts.
Oh, City of Courts. Okay, I'm sorry.
Although it's not even the title anymore anyway. So.
Oh, okay. Now, my understanding is this is your very first comic book. So, I mean, as somebody who you used to write reviews and you used to talk about comics, I think you were on ComicsAlliance.com.
Yeah, I actually do still write about graphic novels and write about comics for a bunch of different places. But, I don't think it's necessarily a problem for people to be on both sides of that particular aisle.
It must be different, though. I mean, you know, you're so used to asking the questions, and here you are having to talk about yourself instead of asking questions. So that's a different process, I imagine.
It is. It's a lot of fun.
Okay. All right. Now, my understanding, too, is that you're a big Judge Dredd fan, so this is the perfect project for you. So you've been reading Judge Dredd for a long time, and I have as well. I've always loved Dredd. I think that he's a crazy character. And I don't think many people in the States really get what goes on there, but clearly you do based on the first issue, which just came out recently and I got a chance to read. So I want to congratulate you on getting a great first issue out that sets the stage for what's going to happen next.
Thank you so much.
Did you have, now you got a lot of research on Dredd already in order to be able to do stuff. And I guess I should ask you right out of the gate, what did you think of the recent Dredd movie with Carl Urban in it?
I really like that movie.
Did you?
I thought it was a terrific movie, got a lot of the stuff from comics that translated well to movies. Mm-hmm. And it's an hour and a half long. It's super exciting. If you got to see it in 3D, made amazing use of 3D, terrific performances, terrific scripts. It's a good movie.
Well, I agree with you. I really liked it. I thought it was a great movie, and all these people were criticizing it. But like I said, I don't think people get Dredd in the U.S. You know, Judge Dredd came from the U.K., and in the U.K. they have very different sensibilities than we have over here. You know, there's a subtleness to the humor in Dredd that I don't think Americans get very often. And it's also ultra-violent compared to stuff, you know, than we're used to over here. But over in the U.K., that's the way they do things. They find that hysterically funny.
Right.
To do those sorts of things. Now, my understanding is when you were a youngster, you got involved with reading Dredd.
Yeah, I mean, I've been reading it most of the time since I was about 12 years old. Like, I kind of glommed onto it when I was 12, visiting the UK, picked up a whole bunch of issues and just started reading them and just kept going. I did take a break around 2003 when I moved out to Oregon. I couldn't find copies of 2008 AD anymore, but then a few years after that, the Case File series started up, the complete reprinting of all the original stories, and I thought, maybe I'll pick up a few of these and see if it's as good as I remember it, and of course picked them up and thought, like, wow, this is actually better than I remember it. All right.
Mm-hmm. Well, you learned, I mean, over time, your appreciation of what the storytelling is all about kind of grew. And so now all of a sudden you go back and look at it as an adult and you get some of the subtleness out of it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are subtle aspects to what goes on there. There's also totally unsubtle stuff.
Yeah.
But,
See, I wish people understood that about Dredd. It's not, you know, this isn't really ultra-violent in the sense that that's the only thing going on. Right. There's little subtle things that go on. There was a one time, there was a great picture I saw of Dredd, and it was in a comic book store. And the poster had Dredd, and he's pushing the cigarette back into the mouth of the person smoking. And he goes, "No smoking here," kind of stuff. And I busted out laughing when I saw it. And the people in the bookstore are like, "What? What's that? I don't get it." I said, "Oh, come on. That's Dredd. Dredd does – like there was a story when he was on the moon, I think, or Mars. And he was – they had the air company that
–
if you didn't –
board, yes.
Yes, yes, the oxygen board. And I and in the end, of course, they steal all this money and they get into the place, but they didn't pay the oxygen board bill, and so they're basically all dead in there. All this planning and going and fighting with Dredd and all this stuff meant nothing because they didn't get the oxygen board bill paid.
That's a great story. The amazing thing about that story is how totally economical it is. I think that's like 6 or 7 pages long, and it still it does so much stuff, and it's so funny, and it's so well put together. And, of course, Brian Bolland was drawing it, so it looks absolutely gorgeous, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's one amazing thing about the series, how many incredible artists have worked on it over the years, and how totally different they are from one another. And that's one of the things that was a real joy about working on this, working with Ulysses Farinas, who his work looks nothing like anybody who's done it before, and it looks fantastic. And a lot of the great Dredd artists, their work looks nothing like each other's work.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good thing, I think. I think when you come to a classic character like Dredd is, you bring your own interpretation pretty much. And to me, I thought the art in the first issue was great. I thought it was terrifically stuff. It was very different from what I'm used to seeing, but it perfectly fit, you know, Dredd and his escapades. I love that you've got him on a car instead of a cycle. I love all the little changes you did. And of course, I have to think now that, you know, Mega City 1 is New York and Washington and all these things all sort of blended together. You go out to California. As anybody who has visited California or lives there, you live up in the West Coast, north of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's, to me, you've got the sensibilities of what California would be like in that future real well. I just laughed out loud at a couple of places. I just thought that was hilarious.
Thank you.
All the stuff about the Hollywood kind of thing and everything having to do with the film industry and things like that. Dredd would have nothing to do with that, and he absolutely hates what's going on over there.
Yeah.
So I just think that's just, you know, fish out of water story. That is just perfect because Dredd does not understand this jockeying and having to discuss things with people. He's a judge.
Right.
You know, he passes sentence on everybody. So because he hadn't been to Mega City 2, although we knew it existed before. Did you do any kind of research as to what – did you look up previous mentions of Mega City 2?
Absolutely. In fact, there are almost no appearances of Mega City 2 before. The Cursed Earth, that long storyline in 1978 where Dredd has to, you know, be in a bike convoy across the country for bizarre plot reasons to get the antidote to a plague there. We actually got to see Mega City 2 on panel for just like a page and a half or something.
Mm-hmm.
There's a tiny little bit of it that's in a story from 2008, the annual called Shock, which was actually adapted into the movie Hardware from, I think, 1990 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And there we just did the first page of that was on Mega City 2. Mm-hmm. And then I think there's a little flashback to it in one of Garth Ennis' stories, Babes in Arms. And then there's another Garth Ennis story that came out in 1992 called Judgment Day, where Mega City 2 gets nuked to a cinder. So there's nothing left of it at this point. But if you notice, we set our story before the beginning of the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still there. And we hadn't really gotten to explore it at length before. So, you know, Ulysses and I got to make most of it up.
So, yeah, that is such a British sensibility to me. You blow up the whole mega city.
Yeah.
You know, that they love nothing better over there. When I see stuff from Europe, I'm always intrigued how they view American ideals.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they look at us. There was an animated movie that was about a woman in France, and everybody in France was all very gaunt, almost skeletal. Like when they came over to this country, they get to New York, and everybody is grossly obese walking down the street,
right.
Almost insultingly so. And when I see, you know, things like that, when the Brits look at American culture, they don't get us, just like we don't get them a lot of the time. So I think you had to do a lot of good research to get that together and make it work. But after the first issue, I'm really enjoying it, and I really can't wait to see what Dredd does next.
Well, you know, I feel like I'm kind of an outsider-insider, and actually, John Wagner, who's written the great bulk of Judge Dredd stories over the years, is kind of an outsider-insider for American culture, too. I mean, he grew up in Scotland, but he was born in the U.S. He's from Pennsylvania originally, and he's been, a UK person for many, many years. But he has, he has that background in the States. And I don't live in California. I've never lived in California, but I've spent a lot of time there. And I used to be an East Coast person. Now I'm a West Coast person. And so I have this kind of very strange relationship to California, and having that kind of push-pull, that's one of the things that made it fun for me.
Mm-hmm. Now, I should ask you, what is it, because I kind of said what appeals to me about Dredd, what is it that appeals to you about Judge Dredd?
There's so many things. I love the world building of it, obviously. I love that it's one long, continuous story, and that the characters age in real time, so all the characters are 37 years older now than they were when the series began. I love that it has all these kind of strange conventions of how the stories are told that make it so different from practically any other serial I can think of. And I love that he's a protagonist who, number one, has practically no interiority. There is something going on in there, but we never get more than a glimpse of it. And number two, that he's a genuinely terrible person. he's unequivocally a hero. He's unutterably brave. He's devoted his life to this ideal, and he's a monster. there's a lot of tension there to play with. Yeah.
Oh my goodness. This is. I think you grasped the whole thing on Dredd, and I don't think every writer does. This is what makes Wagner's work so great, is that he does that. And we've had, he's teamed up with Batman in the past. He's done some other stuff, and it always felt a little off center to me. But this one feels right in there with Dredd's sensibility. So I really like that.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm trying.
Now, as far as how did you get to write this book? I mean, it's coming out from IDW, and of course, it's a property, obviously, that IDW has the rights to, especially in America. How did this come to be that you actually got to write this miniseries?
IDW has been publishing a monthly Judge Dredd book for about a year and a half. And when that started, Chris Ryle, the editor, got in touch with me and asked me if I wanted to write a text piece for the back of the first issue, just to give some history of the series. Mm-hmm. And that turned into writing a text piece in the back of every issue. Mm-hmm. And that turned into his asking if I wanted to pitch a miniseries. And this is what I came up with, and we just kind of refined it from there. And then when Ulysses Farinas got involved, it suddenly got much, much, much more interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, this is going to be a miniseries going to go for, what, five issues?
Five issues, yeah.
Yeah, so after that, do you have other ideas for Dredd stuff that we could enjoy going forward?
Oh, man, I don't know of any other comics I'm going to be writing after this. I'd love to do some more, but that's, the first issue just came out. We'll see what people think.
Okay, I mean, have you... As we said before, you've been in the comic press, now you're writing. Do you check out what other people are saying about your books?
I've been poking around just to see. They say, don't read the comments or read the reviews, but I've been looking what people have been saying, and it's fascinating. I really enjoy seeing what people make of this thing that I've kind of released into the world.
Because I read one that was almost very negative about that it was just standard Dredd stuff is what they were saying. And I felt like saying, do you get the character. I mean, this is what the character is. You know, to see him out there and dealing with Californians and dealing with stuff in a different setting and have – and that's the worst place in the world for him to be. He understands Mega City 1. And he, but he doesn't get Mega City 2 at all. And so, you know, I, watching him struggle and try to, you know, respect authority as he does, but try to figure out what's going on, to me, it's just, it's very enjoyable to watch him do that kind of stuff. So I couldn't figure out what this, as I read the article, it just, standard Dread. But that's,
you know, it's fine. You know, if people pay their $4, they are entitled to whatever they think of it. I love reading criticism. I love reading what people have to say. I love reading what didn't work for people as well as what did. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, one of the things that we were trying to do with this is very consciously take all of his tools away from him and see what's left. The idea of putting him in a car on the first page was an obvious, it's an obvious gag. But it's also, he's associated so closely with his bike. He's associated so closely with his gun that I wanted to take away those surface things, but I also wanted to take away the core of what makes him able to do what he does, which is his absolute belief in the law as this thing that is his North Star. That is his ultimate good. And make it impossible for him to find his way by that North Star. And then now, he does.
Yeah, well, now the thing that gets me is, and I won't spoil anything, but let's just say towards the end of the first issue, we see a motorcycle appear.
Yes.
Which I, of course, the moment I saw it, I just laughed out loud. I said, oh, great. I said, this person has it, but not Dread. And I laughed out loud when I saw that because he's probably going to look at it longingly, you know, as he wants to see things happen.
I'll tell you, actually, that is in fact Dread.
Oh, it is Dread.
Yeah, he's undercover. That's.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Going to see him doing next issue.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes perfect. Of course, that's a good reason for him to get on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
He's going to love that. Oh man, that's him undercover in California. That will be something interesting to see.
Oh yes. I kind of want to take on a different aspect of California for every issue. I don't know if you've probably seen some of the images in the solicits, like the amazing covers that Ulysses Farinas has been doing for this. The second one, the first one is kind of the Hooray for Hollywood issue. The second one is much more about the way that California breeds subcultures and the weird little cults and art movements and things that like that that spring up. And then the third one is kind of about beach culture and ocean culture and all the things that come in with that. And then the fourth one, I'm not even going to spoil the fourth one. I'll just let you figure it out.
Okay. Well, seeing Dread on a beach will be something. That'll be right there. Talk about fish out of water. And the amazing thing, I'm sure, is we won't see him without his helmet once.
That's true. We will never see his face. That's one of the rules.
Yeah, unlike Sylvester Stallone, who had his helmet off every 5 minutes, felt like to me. I just think that's one of the great mysteries of Dread is just who is this guy?
He doesn't have a face because there's kind of not a person in there. There is not a full person in there. We get little hints of who he is, but he's cut himself so far off from most human impulses that he doesn't realize he's having them when he has them. And that's something that John Wagner has been doing really beautifully and really subtly over the years. You will occasionally get to see him do things that you understand why he's doing them, but he doesn't. That's phenomenal. Just as a way of writing.
Have you ever been in touch with Wagner?
Never have. He keeps to himself. He's very quiet.
There's a lot of British writers that way.
Yeah, well, he especially, he doesn't like doing interviews. He's work speaks for itself. He's not somebody who's isolated in the way that Steve Ditko or somebody is isolated. But he's I do the work. That's my job. Great. That's absolutely fine.
It's like Alan Moore. Alan Moore does not want to do interviews very often, and he does. You know, his writing is very brilliant. Like I said, the Brits have a very unique perspective, and so for us to see it, it's stuff I would never dream of. You know, and I think you, but you understand that, and I think you've tapped into all those good things with Mr. Dredd, and I think that he is just God. And you're right, the art really accentuates his personality and makes it stand out. But all that detail, I mean, you know, I would, this is one of the reasons why I think, you know, writers get, you know, admire artists, because how long it took him to draw that stuff, I can't imagine.
Yeah, that gigantic two-page spread on the second, third pages, that was, I think, 150 or so words worth of the script. And there was one image that I sent him just as a point of inspiration. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, he and I talked it over instant message for, you know, a couple hours, and then he spent a week of his life drawing it, and then Ryan spent a week of his life coloring it.
Wow.
And it looked amazing.
It is astounding, I have to say. Are we going to see more of those kind of sequences going forward? Are they going to, or is he going to stick to more or less regular panels?
Again, without spoiling it, there's some really spectacular visual stuff coming up.
Oh, good. Oh, good. Because I'm looking forward to that.
Ulysses is fantastic, and one of the things I love about working with him is that he will always take the more exciting, more spectacular way of drawing something. There's actually a little bit that I wrote in the second issue where I said, okay, there's two ways to do this panel. This is the easy way. This is the unbelievably hard way. And of course, he came up with a way that was like even more complicated than the unbelievably hard way.
No, he's earning his money. That's all I can tell you. Is that just amazing? Now, I'm kind of curious, just because Judge Dredd is a British creation. Mm-hmm. Any chance that the books that IDW are doing, like your miniseries, will go over to the UK and people over there will get to read them?
Well, they are. I mean, I think they're going through Diamond. Like, you can get them over there. People regularly discuss that stuff on the 2080 bulletin boards, which is mostly British people. Yeah, I mean, they do get exported. They do go over there. So.
Oh, good. Well, I'll be curious to see you. Have they given you much of a reaction at this point?
Not so much.
It's only been out.
I'm really curious to see what British readers have to say.
Yeah, it's going to be real interesting, because I just... You know, I keep saying it because it's so true, is that you've caught the lightning in the bottle that is Dredd in my mind. And it's, you know, to see him go other places is such a great thing. And we're going to learn a little bit about who he is by how he reacts to these crazy circumstances. And I think I'm really looking forward to how that's going to work out in the next couple of issues.
Thank you so much. So I should ask you, actually, do you have any particular favorite Dredd stories?
Well, I think I said the one that the oxygen board. Because that just, you know, they go, like I said, they go through all this stuff and they end up, because they didn't pay their bill, they end up losing everything, you know, at the end. That kind of sensibility that Dredd has.
Right.
You may think you're getting away with something, but then something you haven't figured out is going to come back and haunt you. I mean, as far as I remember, did Dredd ever find out what happened to them?
I don't think so. I mean, that story came and went. There's a really fun serial that I believe Rob Williams wrote back in around 2005 called Breathing Space. It was a Dredd spinoff that ran in 2008 that was more about the culture of the moon and the culture of like what happens when you have to pay for oxygen.
You know, that whole thing to me was just, it was witty in the sense of it, you know. I just love that. I thought that was great. So I'm looking forward, because I think you're tuned in right to that sensibility, and I think it's going to be fun to see how this goes out. Now, this is monthly, right?
Yeah, it'll be monthly. I believe that's the plan.
Okay, great. Now, there's another book that you've written that I kind of want to talk a little bit about with you. It's a regular book called Reading Comics, How Graphic Novels Work and What They Mean. It came out in 2007. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because I'm fascinated by the concept.
Sure. I mean, it's from 7 years ago, so I'm a little bit distant from it now, but I'm still very happy about it. What do you want to know?
Well, I mean, as far as the concept of graphic novels, you know, some people look at them and don't see that there's a lot going on. But to me, I love a longer story where you actually can kind of see things from go on for a while, and you get the, instead of like the monthly comic where things have to go come back toward to the place, you know, the reset button has to happen every month. Sometimes graphic novels end and the characters in them are self-contained within the graphic novel. So to me, I like a graphic novel because I get more story. I also get a chance for more character development in it. And I was just curious, is that was that kind of thing that you were interested in when you wrote the book?
Well, I mean, it's about comics as a medium and whatever form they take. I put graphic novels in the title because that's the $20 word for that's the $20 word for the form.
Okay.
I think of it more as a as a term of art, as you know, it's a graphic novel if it's comics in a square bound book, pretty much. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really apply to what kind of story is inside it, or whether it's a long form story or whatever. And that it would be nice if there were a particular term that meant that, but there's not anymore because they're all sold as graphic novels. Mm-hmm. What the book was really about was it was a lot of sort of close readings of particular comics or bodies of comics work that I thought were special or important or interesting, and also talking about the way that we read comics and how we understand them and how we process them and how much of that information has to do with the visual side and how much of it has to do with style and how it's not really wise, it's not really accurate to think of long form or short form comics narratives as the same thing as writing, as things they're just text, just because there's so much about not just images, but about drawing, about the work of a particular artist's hand.
Mm. Well, you got two awards for it. I think you got the Eisner Award, I think, in 2008, and the same year you got a Harvey Award for it. So that's pretty cool. Now, of course, I ask everybody this because there's a movement going on right now that I don't know. If you're going to write that book now, you'd probably have to deal with the subject of digital comics.
Okay.
And what's your impression of digital comics and going forward, how they're going to impact the industry?
They're lovely. You know, let 100 flowers bloom and 100 schools of thought contend, as Mao Zedong said. There's stuff that you can do digitally that you can't really do in print. Mm-hmm. They're a slightly different reading experience. Mm-hmm. They're basically a different variety of the same thing. Mm-hmm. I have not yet seen digital comics that were drastically, drastically different in effect than they would have been as print things. Mm-hmm. There are some things that are better suited for them, mm-hmm. but they're also a really new form, just really just a few years old. And it's I'm sure somebody is going to come up with something absolutely brilliant sometime in the next 10 years, maybe the next 2 years, maybe the next 3 months. Mm-hmm. If you look at some digital comics on Comixology, by far the most fun ones to read are the ones that are digital native, because they're made for the format that you're looking at them in. If you're just taking pages from print comics and pasting them onto the screen, that's fine. The colors can be pretty vivid. If you're shrinking down pages that were originally meant to be seen in the bigger size, then it doesn't quite work as well. If you're blowing up images that were originally meant to be seen in the smaller size, that also doesn't quite work as well. But some of the stuff that's being done specifically for digital, like, that's just right. That is the artist's intention, and that it's made to be experienced that way.
Mm-hmm. See, there's a couple things about this that interest me.
Yeah.
Number one, like, for example, DC Comics puts out like a digital comic almost every day of the week. Mm-hmm. And then they put them out in paper after that. And so sometimes I find myself double dipping. I'm getting the digital so I can look them out on my iPad. Right. And then I also find myself running out to buy a paper copy so I can keep it.
There you go.
Which is, DC makes a lot of money off of me.
That is a canny financial strategy on their part.
Yeah. Yep. The other thing that gets me, too, is I have shown, because I have an iPad, and I have shown people comics on it. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have told me that they like the color of it. It's much sharper. It's much there's a lot more variety to the color than you get on a printed page. And so a lot of people are saying they don't ever want to touch paper again because of the color, the sharpness to it, which I find interesting because, you know, a lot of companies are kind of wondering what to do now. Do we go digital? Do we stop paper? Do we keep going? And the related to that is the other thing about collectability.
Right.
You know, a PDF or a CBZ or any of these other files, they're not really collectible items like a print copy is. And I'm starting to see some of the stores kind of wonder what to do. I mean, I go into these stores and I've got some of the paper copies there. But they say sometimes the digital market is driving down the price of the collectible comics.
You know, the sooner this particular medium detaches itself from the idea of things being collectible, the healthier everybody's going to be. Printed comics that are physically beautiful items that people like to hold in their hands, mm-hmm. those do great.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no such thing as scarcity anymore for content, and mm-hmm. to pretend that there is means that you're just kind of making a bargain that is not going to make a whole lot of sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, when the new 52 came out, DC had people in line waiting to get the number ones and stuff like that. And some of the Marvel Nows have had some of the same thing. So I'm just kind of – the industry is evolving and not necessarily in the way we want. I often think that instead of going to the comic store, we'll take our computers and go to a certain FTP site and pay for things and download them rather than actually go to the store.
Yeah. That's possible. On the other hand, you know, the stores that are doing well even now, especially, are the ones that specialize in selling the things that, well, number one, selling the things that you actually want to have and hold in your hand, mm-hmm. things that are really nicely produced, things that are meant to be experienced on paper, and things that are built for that instead of mm-hmm. being built to just like crank them out as cheaply as possible. And then also the stores that make shopping there a really pleasant experience. Like, you go in there, there are a lot of comic stores that are just kind of terrifying little basements. and those are not necessarily the ones that are going to do well in the long term. The stores that you walk in there and, like, you're in the happy place full of beautiful things, and there are people there who can help you find the stuff that you never even knew existed that's going to make you even happier, that's where people are going to go to spend their money. That's where they go and spend their money now.
See, what made me laugh was that there's a store in the area. It used to be called the Closet of Comics, and it was actually in the basement, and people used to refer to it as the Basement of Comics.
Yeah.
Because there was all this stuff, and it was in there, and the guy had a dog, of course, and there was all this stuff and the smell of yellowing paper and the dog and all this kind of stuff. It did very well, but, you know, I was reticent to buy back copies of things because, you know, I was afraid when I got it home what it would look and smell like. So it's just funny to me that you say that, because I have seen so many. There was one called Magic Comics. You should have black stuff hanging from the walls and stuff like that to give it sort of a dark, mystical feel. And I'm kind of like, no, I just want to buy a comic. I don't want this stuff.
I don't want to go into a store that makes me feel like I'm about to get nerd herpes.
Oh, man, the industry, I hate to say it, going forward is going to be something to watch in the next couple of years. And one last question for you. As somebody who evaluates comics and as somebody who writes reviews and things like that, what comics coming out today, if somebody said to you, look, what comics would you recommend as far as add my reading? Because I love variety. I love all kinds of different things. I like Dread. I like Batman. I like Mouse Guard. I like all kinds of different things. What books would you recommend to people if they asked you,
all right,
what would you like to do?
Stuff that's coming out right now that I really, really like. I love Sex Criminals. That's mm-hmm. such a clever thing, so beautifully executed. Mm-hmm. So the Matt Fraction, Chip Zdarsky thing. Mm-hmm. Have you read that film?
I have. I'm conflicted on that book, I'll tell you, because to me, it could be Sleep Criminals as far as that goes, but because of the sex, that's a little more titillating, so we go with the sex business. But to me, I mean, it's an interesting story. Matt Fraction, of course, does Hawkeye, which is also another interesting book. So I'm going to keep reading it, but I won't be as enthusiastic about the book as some other folks are, I think. But that's a good book. I mean, you know, hey, something different.
Other stuff I really love. I love Saga. Mm-hmm. Saga is just amazing, and it just beautifully conceived, beautifully executed. I also really love The Private Eye, which is the Brian K. Vaughan, Marcos Martin digital-only comic. That's just great and thought-provoking and fun. Mm-hmm. There's a book called Copra by Michael Fife, I think his name is pronounced. I don't know how to pronounce his name, probably pronouncing it wrong. It's self-published. He's an art comics guy who really, really, really loves like mid-80s Suicide Squad. Mm-hmm. And so he's doing his own riff on just that kind of atmosphere and that kind of tone. And it's a full-on superhero comic, but it's coming from this like crazy art comics background, and that's mm-hmm. really great. Michael DeForge is doing some really interesting things. Anything Carla Speed McNeil does, I will read and love. She and Alex DeCampi just did the My Little Pony one-shot that came out yesterday. Mm-hmm. But I haven't seen it yet. I'm dying to read it just because everything that Carla Speed McNeil does is so good that I actually really want to read My Little Pony comic. Mm-hmm.
Are you kind of steering away from superhero comics as time goes along?
I am and I'm not. I mean, actually, one of my very favorite comics right now is The Superior Foes of Spider-Man.
Mm-hmm.
It's the B title. It's not the main Spider-Man comic. It's mm-hmm. a spinoff, and it's wonderful. Again, it's something where Nick Spencer and Steve Lieber, the writer and artist, went in with this idea of a very specific look and feel, a very specific tone to it, and they've come up with something that's just not like anything else and completely charming. It's just a joy to read every month.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good. Well, I think this is one of the best times to buy comics that I've lived through, and I've been reading them for decades. There's so much variety, and there's so much interest and so much good storytelling happening that, to me, I think, as a comics reader, I can't remember a better time.
Yeah, the golden age is right now.
Yeah, I think so. I really do. Well, as far as Judge Dredd goes, I hope you get to write a lot more, and you're off to a great start with the book. And tell me again what the title was, just so I got it straight.
Oh, it says Judge Dredd Mega City 2.
Okay. All right. So I highly recommend it. If you like Judge Dredd, or even if you don't like Judge Dredd, I think you're going to enjoy this comic. It's from IDW. Be sure to get to your comic store as soon as you can. And I hope we get to read a lot more stuff from you, Doug, and we get to see your take on some other characters, too, in the future.
Thank you so much, Wayne. I'm hoping so, too.
That's a wrap for this episode. Be sure to be back next week when we'll have more interviews and other good things. But until then, keep reading your comics.